Amanda Knox is finding new support in unlikely places. Her case has been scrutinized by Steve Moore, who was an FBI agent for 26 years.
At first, I believed she was guilty. I mean, I'm law enforcement.
But after studying every iota of evidence...
The evidence didn't just say she didn't do it. The evidence proved that she couldn't have done it.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clementi, former New York City prosecutor and retired FBI profiler. I'm also the writer and producer on CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today is...
Laura Richards, advocate, analyst, and activist. And I'm founder and director of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service and also co-creator and producer on the case of JonBenet Ramsey.
And I'm Lisa Zambetti. I'm the casting director for Criminal Minds, where Jim Clementi is my colleague. I have a real interest in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes.
Well, this is our second installment in our conversation with Steve Moore, retired FBI agent, who actually got involved in investigating and helping out in the defense of Amanda Knox during her appeal process and finally her exoneration. Okay, Steve, let's pick up where we left off.
So one thing, Steve, that you really kind of changed my mind about, all this time I really thought that Mignini, that he really believed that what he was saying, that Amanda was this, you know, diabolical temptress.
My observations of him and his behavior and everything that he's said and done since he actually set foot on that crime scene on day one is that he saw it as an opportunity to make something huge about this as a distraction so that people in the community, people in his country, did not look at him as a criminal anymore.
I have a theory.
Go ahead.
Mignini, follow me through on my logic here. And FBI agent to FBI agent, I'm going to give you a scenario and you come up with a conclusion for me.
Okay.
You're a prosecutor in town. You have a lot of drug dealing because it's a college town. You have a guy in town who's doing burglaries. This guy goes and does a burglary in Milan, and he's arrested. Then Milan police get a phone call from the Perugia police saying, we need him back in our town, this burglar drug dealer. Please give him his belongings back, put him on a train back to Perugia. What is that all about?
Well, the only situation in which I have ever heard of one police department interfering with the case in another jurisdiction is if that police department was using that defendant
as an informant. Yeah. So here you have, to me, prima facie evidence that this person was an informant. You don't, when you have a burglar and a drug dealer in your town and he gets arrested in the other town, you know what you do?
You celebrate.
Open the champagne. He's gone. We'll never see him again. You don't call them back and say, we miss him. Send him back. We won't have anything to do if he's gone. No, you only do that if he's reporting to the police. And guess what his burglaries were? His burglaries were second floor jobs where he took burglarized defense attorneys and took their laptops. What's on the laptops? It's the defense strategy for cases against or defending against Mignini.
So now, the first time I've ever heard that.
I didn't realize that.
This is all verified stuff. And so I'm going to let you make your own conclusions. So every time he was caught with these laptops, do you know what he was told to do by the police? Return them. And he wasn't prosecuted. So the Milan incident happens the week before Meredith Kircher is murdered. He's brought home, and then he knows for sure that the girls in the upstairs apartment in this cottage are gone for the weekend because his friends told him so. It is the day before rent's due. It is usually paid in cash in Italy, and he breaks in looking for the cash.
Mm-hmm.
Meredith Kircher comes home sick. Then you have what you have. So now you're the prosecutor who got this man out of jail, and a week later, he's murdered somebody.
Right.
In Italy, you own that.
Right, and you want to shift the focus onto somebody else as far away as possible so that you can prevent people from understanding that if you hadn't gotten him out of jail, Meredith Kircher would still be alive. That's a reasonable conclusion.
So some of the early witnesses, from what I'm told, some of the early witnesses described a black man near the residence. Menini probably went cold when he heard that. There are two prominent, well-known black men, African-Italian men in town. One was Rudy Gaudet, and the other one was Amanda's boss at the bar. And so when the police brought her in to testify, after 53 hours of interrogation over 5 days, the last of which started at 10 p.m. and went to 6 a.m., they got her. You know why an interrogation ends? You either give up or you get what you want.
Right.
And if you get what you want, you have them sign a statement.
And then you stop.
She signed a statement, and all it said was, "I saw my boss go into that room." They weren't trying initially, I believe, to prosecute her. They were trying to prosecute her boss. And when the fingerprints and the DNA came back and it wasn't her boss, they had to prosecute her. Otherwise, the jig was up.
Yeah, well, they had to prosecute her for not telling them the truth.
Exactly.
Right, but...
But that interrogation, I mean, there was no interpreter, no lawyer... And wasn't there, on one of the particular nights, there was an all-night interrogation of her by 12 detectives that were drafted in from Rome.
And think about this. They said that we just brought her in because we needed to talk to her. No, you don't do that, because if you've got 12 detectives, you got to pay them overtime.
Right.
And so there was an interpreter.
You've got to have a strategy.
The interpreter only came for the last 2 hours.
Oh, really?
She was not there. And that's why everybody, all these haters say that she was only interrogated for 2 hours because the interpreter logged in here and here.
Oh.
And that's just garbage. She went in at 10 o'clock with, actually, she wasn't, in my understanding, she wasn't called in. She went in with Raffaele.
Right.
And maybe they intended to do a heavy push on him to get him to rat her out. And that wasn't working. So they ended up focusing on her. But apparently they did this tag team. They had 6 police officers from Rome and 6 locally. And they did a 2x2 tag team all night on her.
Which is standard coercive interrogation methods against terrorists in some countries.
Right. And we don't use that because it is coercive. And anything you get out of an interrogation in that way would be excluded from a trial because it is coercive.
And she was 20 years old at the time. I mean, that's the other thing, just how young she was to go through something like this. And, you know, depending on, of course, it's her account, but she says that she was called names and she was called stupid and she was fatigued and exhausted. And none of this apparently was videoed. But isn't it by law in Italy that you have to at least have audio when you're interviewing or interrogating?
Yeah, and they tapped her phone. I mean, they were able to record all of that, yet not this interrogation. That's just such bullshit.
And this is the only interrogation involved in this case where they forgot to record it.
Yeah, well, I don't know if it's the only one, because I think the first meeting between Magnini and Guede was not recorded.
Oh,
because
right.
In the one that is recorded, they reference back to the first time you said, and Magnini somehow, miraculously, had information that Guede didn't even give him during this, and many times he suggested information to Guede.
Imagine that.
I mean,
the whole way through, he suggested information and put words into his mouth. And it's such a stark contrast to what happened over these hours where she was interviewed or interrogated consecutive days, where she wasn't allowed breaks and didn't have a lawyer with her and didn't have an interpreter. And of course, she's not fluent in Italian. So it must have been incredibly difficult for her going through this, not knowing what they're even accusing her of in the first place.
Right. And Steve, you weren't here, but we talked about the amazing things that happened in this case in the Guede interrogation by Magnini. First of all, Guede does a voice identification of Amanda Knox while he's in the bathroom listening to headphones, right? A voice identification of a person who he's only met once or twice in his life. A very, very limited amount of her voice that he has heard. And then he does a gravel identification, and that is he heard footsteps of multiple people on the gravel. He's got amazing
hearing.
He's
great.
He is. And then, way about his eyesight, he does a silhouette identification of Amanda Knox as she goes off into the night. And again, McNeeny forces him into this, just pushes and pushes until he finally says that. And even when he says it, he says, well, I couldn't see any detail, but McNeeny tries to get him to say, well, you had a very precise recollection that this was her. And he's like, no, it was like her silhouette. So again, and you know what he testified to ultimately, or yeah, what he eventually, what his statement eventually turned into. But it's clear that McNeeny pushed him into that position. And it's also clear that he got a sweetheart deal of it. And that he is actually out of jail at this early date when he committed such a brutal, horrific sexual assault and murder.
And what Menini did is not just a crime against Amanda Knox. It's a crime against Meredith's family. It's a crime against Meredith. This is one of the most horrific things because he's taken so many people in with this lie.
I mean, yeah, and he's hurt the family because they still don't know what actually happened. They still
they seem still very confused by
everything.
They're
not willing to accept what really happened, I believe.
Well, at this point, because they had locked on to everything McNeeny said before.
They imprinted.
Yes. It's absolutely unbelievable what he did to this family. Since we are basically talking about this, the Getty, quote, interrogation, we've discussed in detail. Can you tell us in your interactions with with Amanda Knox and her legal team, what exactly happened from your perspective as an investigator, as a seasoned professional investigator? Because in my mind, Amanda is not her best advocate. I don't think she focuses. She explains in detail why she actually did and said the things that she did in that interrogation.
Now, are you asking me to describe what happened in the interrogation or in the actual crime?
No, just in the interrogation at this point.
Amanda was 20 at the time, but I think she was kind of a late bloomer. She would not be found as a cheerleader at her high school, hanging out with the football stars. She's more likely hanging out with the chess club people.
Really?
She was young for her age at that time. Sadly, now I think she's much more mature and wizened for her age than other people. But at that time, she was relatively naive and believed in that when police say they're trying to find the killer, you want to help. I mean, this was her best friend in Italy. And so the interrogations began in that week with her believing, strongly believing that she was helping the police. In fact, her mother, the night before the overnight interrogation, called her and said, Amanda, don't stay in the country. There's something wrong with this. And Amanda had relatives in Germany. And she said, go be with them. And Amanda said, no, I want to stay and help find who killed my friend.
So that tells you something about who she is and what her motivations are.
As opposed to Guede, who left town.
He went out partying, first of all, didn't he, before he left?
He went dancing, yes.
Right. Unbelievable.
If you look, but one of the things I did early on is after I realized that Amanda Knox could not have committed this crime, I decided to go up and I had never met anybody in her family, never spoken to anybody in her family before I came to this conclusion. I went up and did essentially what you profilers would have sent us out to do. Investigate her background, interview her friends, interview her teachers, interview people who didn't like her and come up with a behavioral profile of her. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that struck me is everybody laughed at kind of how naive she was and laughed in a very affectionate way. But they also talked about a level of compassion that was unusual. Mm. One of the things she did more than once, apparently, was bring home an animal who had been killed in the road to bury it because she believed that the animal deserved better than to lie in a street. Mm. When she graduated high school, I believe it was high school, they did not have, at that time, an award to give somebody for compassion. So they created one because they didn't want her to graduate without having that award. This is the person that Menini chose. And the fact that Amanda does not present well on camera, or doesn't have the right words, or doesn't have the innate knowledge of what she should say politically. Right. She doesn't.
There's no filter.
There's no filter. Yeah. She will say what she's thinking. And because of that, she is not her own best advocate.
Okay, guys, just hold that thought. Let's take a break. And when we come back, we'll continue our discussion.
But all attention now is focused on Knox's appeal that should begin in November, when the evidence that convicted her could be re-examined. And the former FBI agent will do all he can to help.
There was no way she had anything to do with the crime. I can sound an alarm. I can tell people. The only thing that is going to free Amanda is good people doing something.
Okay, and we're back. Let's pick up where we left off. But you know what's really unfair is that if there were other Americans living in the house, she wouldn't have stood out as so different and odd. You know, I know a lot of Amandas. You know, my assistant, who I love dearly, is from Seattle. She has all of the same sort of characteristics that Amanda has. And she would, you know, her way into, you know, she wouldn't know to be on guard. You know, she would want to help. She would be right in there. And I could see her, you know, getting into trouble. And then she travels all the time. And I warn her, you know, you have to be careful.
Right.
And so I really kind of, I don't know, I recognize.
Being quirky doesn't make you a murderer. Being quirky doesn't make you an outlier. I mean, lots of people are quirky. You know, I just don't even see that as a good enough reason to explain how this could have happened just because she's a little bit quirky.
But, you're right. But
Laura,
she was guileless.
Right.
That's the problem. If you're guileless, you don't see it in other people.
And you don't see it coming. So you don't, you agree. Because one thing that you said, Steve, that really struck me is that she got an award for compassion. Well, compassion is the outward act that happens when you have a tremendous amount of empathy. And so what do, Laura, when you're empathic? You want to help. You want to help Meredith because she got killed. And you want to help the prosecutor who you think is legitimately trying to solve her murder.
She's putting herself out there.
Yes,
but as you said it, Jim, I mean, you know, the whole point here, we're saying she wasn't her best advocate, but the term advocate comes from being a lawyer. So where was her advocate? Where was her lawyer or interpreter or people, you know, that are there to be her voice in the system? I am an advocate for victims who don't have a voice. And I have to be there for people who are not able to articulate things, may not have a filter, may present in a way because they've got serious post-traumatic stress disorder or whatever it might be. But she didn't have any of those things, did she? Because they had a laser focus on proving a crime against that she committed when there was no evidence to show that she was even in that murder room right from the outset. But even by their own admission, the officials said they weren't interested in the evidence. So there's so many things that just compounded here, not just one. There's multiple things that unfortunately led to what went on, this travesty of justice.
True. And she's not unique. One of the things I did at this university is seminars and individual training of students who are about to go overseas. You would not believe the number of these students who just really didn't understand that they're not bringing the Bill of Rights with them, that people might not really like them because they're Americans. The thought that anybody would not like them because they were Americans didn't occur to them. And the naivete of some of the students going over was jaw-dropping.
Hmm. Yeah, and I think it's something that we have seen, you know, in all the years that we have kind of been involved in looking at this case, we have seen that Amanda's behavior, although it may seem unusual to some people, was absolutely inconsistent with guilty behavior. In fact, the fact that she would immediately after having signed this, what Magnini called a confession, that afterwards she immediately wrote out a note saying, look, don't really pay attention to that. That my memory is really cloudy. It's really not.
I don't even know if that was something you told me or whether I remembered it.
Right. So that is the perfect capsulization of what is a false confession. And when you have red flags as glaring as that, you don't put a lot of weight on it. And certainly it's very easy in this case to have verified that. Instead of verifying it, what they did was they went out and arrested Patrick Lumumba, kept him in jail for days, and then eventually realized, oh my God, this guy has a rock solid alibi. Clearly he was not involved in this case. We can't use him as the patsy. We're going to have to actually admit that this other person that we know breaks into houses like this, that we know carries a knife, that we know burglarizes places like this on the second floor.
And before Rudy gets to make a public statement, we have got to get him in a room and explain his situation and how this is going to work out.
Right, because miraculously, before the police officers from Perugia were able to take him from Germany and extradite him back, Rudy was represented by two very high-priced lawyers. How did they get there? He certainly didn't have the money to hire them.
No, he was indigent.
How did that happen? Do you have any idea?
I cannot
tell you. Nina Burleigh thinks that it was a favor from the family who always gets him out of
But how did the family know? How did the family know that he was in trouble? How did they know? They would have only known if the police had given them that, or the prosecutor had given them that information. At that point, no one publicly knew that Rudy was even involved in this.
And by the way, I think it's worth noting that in a consensually monitored telephone call, when Rudy felt he was talking to one of his best friends, and before he was captured, he said Amanda Knox had nothing to do with this crime.
That's correct.
He had no motive to say that, but he had motive when he got back to say she did.
Right. Well, and the only place he could have gotten that motive from was the investigators or the prosecutors that talked to him. And they may have talked to him through his attorneys.
Yeah. Yeah. Take the 11 years or we give you life and we'll deny everything you say.
Well, I thought it was... I thought at first it was 30 years and then it was knocked down to 16 years because it was the...
Well, I think that was part of the deal because the optics would have been bad. And here's what makes me believe that this was pre-agreed to. Amanda Knox was given 27 years, something like that, from the first trial.
Mm-hmm.
They appealed. Manini appealed saying that wasn't enough. She needed life in prison. At the same time, Rudy Gidet, who went fast track, pled guilty, and got 30 years, asked that his sentence be reduced to 16, and the prosecution didn't object.
Mm.
Think about that. Amanda, they're trying to increase the sentence to life. He's got 30, wants it down, wants it halved, and the prosecutor says, well, that's fine with me. And he knew at that point that if he went 16, he was out in 11, and that's what happened.
Can you talk also a little bit about, it's related to that after that conviction, remember, this was while Raffaele and Amanda were still being held in jail without being charged.
For a year.
For a whole year. And he, Mignini, makes a deal, gets the plea from Rudy, gets the conviction, and then he immediately gets it certified by the Supreme Court. Can you explain a little bit about what that means?
The Supreme Court in Italy is not like the Supreme Court in the United States. We have, help me out, 9 justices. They have hundreds of justices, and they come mainly from the prosecutorial ranks. There is a prosecutor's union there in Italy. And so what happens is it's kind of like fraternity brothers or sorority sisters. They go on to be in the Supreme Court and you can aim cases towards them and they will do things for you, like getting the stamp of approval by the Supreme Court. That was what was so surprising at the end, that Manini could not get the appeal steered to the right people in the Supreme Court. That was, I think, somebody in the Italian government had had enough of Manini's case against Knox and made sure it went to impartial judges.
Oh, that's great. Well, you mentioned something about it being like fraternity brothers or sorority sisters. Are there female judges?
Yes, there are.
On the Supreme Court?
I believe there are. I'd have to verify, but my understanding is there are.
Okay, well, that's pretty progressive. I didn't see any involved in this case.
No, see, what I want to point out here is that the Italians in say, Rome, had a completely different view of this, you know, except for the people who were into tabloids and things. To give you an example, one of the things I did after Amanda was released was get her out of the country safely. And we had reason to believe that Manini would try to throw charges at her. I think he tried to charge her with overstaying her visa, believe it or not, because she was in prison. And so we're trying to get her out of the country. And I called the Leonardo da Vinci Airport and spoke to the head of security at Leonardo da Vinci Airport and told him of my fears.
That's in Rome, right?
Yeah, yeah. And told him of my fears about charges of overstaying the visa. And he says, you know what I do if somebody overstays their visa? I throw them out of the country. And so I brought her to the airport. He had a team of security officers, undercover. They were in plain clothes. He drove her onto the ramp so she didn't have to go through the public. They took her passport. It came back stamped. They checked her luggage, and he brought her personally to the first class Alitalia lounge so she wouldn't have to wait in public. That's how the Romans felt about this.
Yeah.
And while we were there, there was a line of Italians, literally a line, hugging Amanda, crying, apologizing, because Italy felt that Perugia was provincial and this guy was crazy. And so we shouldn't paint with a broad brush.
Right. And I'm sorry. And I know that I have made statements in the past when this was going on that I just can't have any faith in the Italian justice system.
Nor can I.
But in the end, I think the national system, I think in the end, the rest of the country actually, and the even balanced justice system, the actual justice system prevailed, as opposed to the microcosm that Magnini was able to control around the city of Perugia.
Right. And make no mistake, there is a huge amount of corruption within the Italian justice system. But there are a large number of brave, heroic Italians in the justice system who will fight the mob. They will fight corruption, and it costs them. And so I don't want to paint with a broad brush. I think in that first class lounge, though, there were a number of Brits, and the Brits would not even look in her direction because the water had been poisoned.
All right. Well, when we come back, we're going to wrap up this topic. It's really been fascinating talking to you about it and the insights that you've had.
Well, the court sentenced the prosecutor, Giuliano Manini, to 1 year and 4 months, but then suspended the sentence pending an appeal. It's unlikely Manini will be removed from office, but Italian legal experts tell me this is a blow to his credibility, just as Knox's legal team begins her appeal.
So now we're back. Let's talk about just some of the other things about Manini and certainly some of his phrases and quotes where he says things on the Netflix show like no one is a prophet in their own country. Well, I found that really across that whole, just watching him in action across the Netflix documentary, this grand sense, an overinflated sense of self and no responsibility taking was really quite staggering.
Yeah, when he said at the end, well, if they are innocent, I hope they get over it.
How generous of him.
Thanks, guy.
It's almost delusional, and just that whole nod that he kept trying to give to him being very like Sherlock Holmes, with the smoking jacket and the pipe. And I just found these things just so bizarre. He's a caricature in many ways, when you would expect someone, facts and evidence just don't appear to matter or play a part in Magnini's playbook and just the role that he has played in all of this. For me, surely the lens should be turned onto him. Surely he should be the one that's being investigated.
Yeah.
He is. If you saw him strutting around town during the appeal, he tries to make himself bigger than life. He is always with that pipe, and he always walks around with I don't know how he does it, but it's just this air of pomposity that is just that just permeates. And I used to like to play with that when I'd walk by, but it's one of the reasons he didn't like me. But
well, how did you do that?
Oh, I just walked by giving him unique American gestures and wondering if he could translate them.
You were saying earlier, Steve, that you know, Amanda got such a warm send off from the Italians, and I was going to point out that our Facebook listeners who are in Italy actually have a different feeling. They think that they don't
Wait,
think
that
some
of them.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Is they were reporting to me that, you know, most of Italy feels that they are guilty and that Raffaele was a rich, you know, playboy whose father got him out. I mean, our listener doesn't feel that way.
Raffaele
wasn't
a rich playboy. He lived with us after he came he got out of prison. Lived with my family between the rooms of my two daughters, by the way. How's that for putting your money where your mouth is? And he is one of the most genuine, humble, down-to-earth guys. Yes, his parents have money. That's not a crime.
Right now.
Yes, some people in Italy still believe he and she are guilty. But here's the thing. The only people who remain on social media fighting this case are the ones who believed from the beginning that they were guilty. The ones who believe she's innocent are off social media about this case. It's been resolved adequately for them, and so they're not going to be posting. So you are seeing the minority who are still upset. And I believe today, if they held a referendum in Italy on Amanda Knox and Raffaele Sollecito's guilt or innocence, there would be a significant number of people who would say that they believe they were guilty. But I believe that the innocent side would win in a landslide.
Yeah, so the vast majority of people in Italy have now seen the light based on the fact that their own justice system has corrected a grave error and spoke about it. I mean, didn't just say, oh, we're going to find them not guilty. They said, we find that there was significant problems with this investigation and the prosecution, and that there was no evidence to convict them. But we're still left with that taint that's left because Mignini certified the verdict against Rudy Guede, and in that verdict, he claimed that Guede did not act alone, so the Supreme Court can never go against that officially.
Yeah, but they proved him wrong. The Supreme Court did go against that ruling.
Yeah, but in that final ruling, didn't they still maintain that there was other people involved in this murder?
They did that, I believe, so that they didn't have to embarrass colleagues on
right.
the court.
Exactly.
And that's, you know, that's just the way it's going
to
be.
But it's a dichotomy.
And it has a terrible effect. It's like the public says, okay, they're innocent, but they're a little guilty.
Well,
you know,
let me,
I mean,
let me
it's
tell
so
you
confusing.
It is. And here's part of the deal, though. The Italians have two verdicts that you can give. One is not guilty, meaning you haven't proved it, or innocent, meaning that the facts prove their innocence. Innocent is rarely given. Amanda Knox and Raffaele got an innocent in their appeal and the Supreme Court. To get those two in order is unheard of.
Yeah, and I think that's what everybody has to understand. It's only a legal fiction, and we have in this country, and I'm sure you do in the UK, Laura, we have certain legal fictions that we always have to abide by. And for example, let's talk about the detainees in Guantanamo, okay? They weren't called prisoners of war. They weren't called prisoners. They were called detainees. It was a legal fiction because they didn't want them to have the rights of a prisoner of war or of somebody who's convicted of a crime. And they were never tried. So they created this title, detainee. It didn't have any laws relating to it. So they felt free to do whatever they wanted about it. This is a similar example. They have a legal fiction that once you certify a judgment in a particular case by the Supreme Court, you can never overturn that particular judgment. And that was the conviction against Rudy Guede, and it was that he did not act alone. That was evidence that was put in by Mignini that was never challenged in that first trial, and that Raffaele and Amanda were never given representation on. And then it was completely debunked in the subsequent appeal and the final Supreme Court decision.
That's right. And I'm hoping to put it all behind us now.
Yes.
Yeah. So tell us, as we sort of wrap up, how is Amanda doing and what can you tell us about her life now?
She is surprisingly well, given what she's gone through. I lived with the family for some weeks after she came back to just make sure of her welfare. And she has recovered more quickly than I can ever imagine anybody else recovering. She bears no malice. She is sad about not being able to be in contact with Meredith's parents, not being able to visit the gravesite. Things like this, I think, bother her. And it hurts her to know that so many people actually would believe that she's capable of this. That said, she has decided to go on with her life. I speak to her probably once or twice a month, and I become friends with her family. I went up there salmon fishing this year. She is happy. She is going on with her life. She's got employment. She's doing well at that. And every picture I see of her is her smiling.
That's great. And isn't she also taking on the mantle of a victim advocate as well?
Yes. And that was interesting, because the day that she was acquitted by the Supreme Court, that was a surprise to everyone, including her. And I talked to her about an hour and a half after the verdict, and she said, I've got to decide what to do with my life, because I didn't think I was going to have one for a few years. And she literally thought it out, planned it out, as if she was just placed on earth right then and there. What was her greatest value to humanity at that point? And she said, I'm going to become, as much as I can, a victim advocate. And she's thrown herself into that with a great deal of energy. And
Well, we would really like to help her with that if we can. I mean, Laura and I and Lisa would love to help her, because we have not only connections and obviously a network of people, professionals that work in this field, but we have plenty that I think she could help us with.
Well,
and we can help her get there. So I think that would be great.
Her concern right now is maintaining a low profile.
Sure.
Understandably. My goodness.
She wants to help, but I don't think, and this is just a personal opinion, I don't think she wants to be a voice necessarily as much as she wants to be. She doesn't want to be the quarterback. She wants to be the lineman. She wants to move things, because her notoriety kept her in prison for 4 straight years. And I think she wants to be out of the public eye. I mean, she would love to,
yeah, it
to
doesn't
your
have
help.
To be in public. Yeah,
yes,
yeah.
She would love your help and assistance in all of these cases she's working with. But Amanda wants to have a quiet life right now.
Yeah, I was just going to say that, you know, absolutely, I agree with what Jim said, and any assistance in terms of the victim advocacy side that can be offered, you know, happy to do that. But I think, you know, I just want to make a mention of the Kircher family as well, because so many lives have been ruined here. You know, Meredith being the key victim, and with all the sort of BS that's gone on with McNeeney, where he talks about how he loved detective shows, etc. You know, this isn't a game. This is about real people, real lives, real victims. And for the Kirchers, you know, when we started this podcast and I started doing a lot of research around them, you know, they genuinely felt that they didn't get justice here. And that's something we've really tried to unpick. And it's been really helpful having you on, Steve, just to talk about some of the backstory, the things that people have been saying, you know, and the truth of the situation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think from all the forensic evidence, the crime scene assessment, the behavioral analysis, it was very clear there was one killer and one killer alone. Right. And, you know, I do hope that for the Kirchers that they do have a better understanding through the facts and through the evidence, and listening to the right people rather than getting this very biased view from people like Pisa and others who've interpreted things very differently.
it's hard to understand how they have been able to cope with this roller coaster they've been on, and the feeling that they might have been deceived, and then people telling them over and over again, you haven't been deceived. I cannot imagine how they've dealt with it, but they have, they've remained strong, and I wish only that they would have some clarity and some truth in this, because I believe that would lead to healing for everyone.
That's a great, absolutely great goal. And I think the best way to end this series on this case is to say that her name was Meredith.
So if you enjoy our podcast and would like to support us, there are a couple of important things you can do. First, you can go over to iTunes and give us a positive 5-star review. You can check out our sponsors and take advantage of the special promotions for Real Crime Profile listeners. You can go over and like our Facebook page, and you can follow us on Twitter. But most importantly, you can share our podcast with friends, family, and anyone you know would be interested in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes. So thank you for listening.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineered by Terrell Parham. Music composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go on the website www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Helpline free phone 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, safety, shelter or counselling, call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, 214-946-4357, or go on their website, www.genesisshelter.org, or the domestic violence hotline on 800-799-7233.
If you're a regular listener to the show, you know we have great brands like Blue Apron, Audible, and Casper advertising with us, and they keep coming back because our listeners really respond to them, which we're really thankful for. Well, if you happen to own a business or manage the advertising buy for one, then you should consider advertising on Real Crime Profile. Podcast advertising is on the rise, and it's one of the most effective ways of reaching consumers on the go today. So please go to Wondery.com/advertisers. Again, it's Wondery.com/advertisers. And get in touch with us. Thanks.